clean sweater and his pressed slacks, but his expression is anything but vapid. I still don't think that freewheeling George Holly, American investor, has ever been anything but freewheeling George Holly, American investor. But for the first time, that doesn't matter. I think he understands me regardless. So why don't you buy Core from him? I smile thinly. Holly reads my expression. Is it the money? Ah, he's not willing. Do you have no leverage? Surely he needs more from you than to win the races. I'm sorry. I've overstepped. It's not my business. Let's go. Pretend I didn't say anything. But he did say something, and it can't be unsaid. The truth is this. For 11 months of the year, I make myself valuable to Malvern. And then, for 1 month, I make myself invaluable. Would he be willing to give up that 1 month to keep the other 11? Am I willing to risk it? We stand back on the high ground. Holly is white against the green and I am black. I knock out the bucket, glad to leave the contents behind, and Holly wordlessly watches me scoop up a handful of clean dirt and whisper to it before scattering it back over the ground again. Magic, says Holly. Is a snaffle bit magic? I ask him. All I know is that when I whisper to dirt, my conversations are less than meaningful. He watches me treat the other two paths up from the cliffs. He doesn't ask how I do it, and I don't tell him. And then, after we've started back and the quiet seems long for him, I tell him, You can say what you're thinking. No, I can't, George Holly says immediately, glad to be invited to speak. Because it's more of not my business. And seeing as I've poked a stick in my eye once already, I don't want to do it again. I raise my eyebrow. Holly scuffs off his hands as if he's been handling something dirtier than water from the tide pool. All right, then. So what's going on between you and that girl, Kate Connolly, right? I let out a breath, stack my buckets, and head back down the road toward the yard. Holly says, If you think by not answering that you'll convince me there's nothing, it won't work. That's not why I'm not answering, I say as he catches up to me again. I won't say there's nothing. I just don't know what it is. I can see her clearly, standing on the rock beside Peg Grattan, unflinching before Eaton and the rest of the race committee. I can't remember when I've been that brave, and it shames me. The truth is, I feel myself being fascinated and repelled by her. She's both a mirror of myself and a door to part of this island that I'm not. It is like when the mare goddess looked into my eye. I felt that there was a part of myself that I didn't know. I'll tell you what it is in American, George Holly says, but you might not want to hear it. I cast him a withering glance and he laughs with good humor. This is worth every day away from home, he says. Should I gamble on her then? You should save your money for hay, I mutter. It'll be a long winter. Not, says Holly, in California. And he laughs. And from the distance of his laugh, I realize he stopped walking. I turn. I think you're right, Mr. Kendrick, George Holly says, eyes closed. His face is to the wind, leaning forward slightly so that it doesn't tip him. His slacks are no longer pristine. He's tracked bits of mud and manure up the front of them. His ridiculous red hat has blown off behind him, but he doesn't seem to notice. The wind has its fingers in his fair hair and the ocean sings to him. This island will take you if you let it. I ask, what am I right about? I can feel God out here. I brush my hands off on my pants. Tell me that again, I say. 2 weeks from now, when you've seen the dead bodies on the beach. Holly doesn't open his eyes. Let no one say that Sean Kendrick isn't an optimist. After a pause, he adds, I feel you smiling, so don't deny it. He's right, so I don't. You going to try Benjamin Malvern for that horse or what? he asks. I think of Kate Connolly standing before Eaton, her face brave, looking like a sacrifice on that old killing rock. I feel the mare goddess's breath on my face, and it carries the scent of thunder in it. Yes, I say.
Chapter 34. Puck. I don't bother tacking up Dove on Sunday after church. Everyone and their grandpa will be tacking up their Kapel Ishka after they get out of Mass, and I think it might be a good opportunity to learn something about my competition. I'll bring Dove up to the cliffs this evening, maybe, after she's had the day to eat expensive hay and get used to the idea of being fast. I leave Finn and Gabe alone back at the house. Gabe came to service with us, though he looked at his watch and left halfway through, which made Father Mooneyham stare first at him and then at us. Father Mooneyham's homilies are not generally painful, but you're meant to suffer through them nonetheless. If your leg falls asleep, you don't move. If the tea you drank before Mass has you dreaming of toilets on the way to Damascus instead of Epiphanies, you pinch and burn and bear it. If you're Brian Carroll and you have been night fishing, you tip your head back so that holding your eyes open is not such an impossible task. You don't get up and leave. But Gabe did. And then Beach Grattan did as well. If Tommy Fork hadn't been too pretty to come to church in the first place, I'm sure he would have left too. And now I definitely need to go to confession, because I've not only thought dark things about my brother, I've thought them while in Mass. It is slightly uncomfortable to know that if I die in the next few hours, I'll go to hell. But I have to get outside before the tide comes in and all the riders disappear. Anyway, all of that seems far away when I'm out on the cliffs above the racing beach. Because though I don't want to ride on the windy cliffs, I don't mind sitting on them. I trudge out with a pack on my back, made of a wool blanket gathered into a pouch, and when I get there, I release its contents on the ground and find myself a secure perch close to the edge, where I can see the training down below. I wrap the blanket around my shoulders, take a sip of tea from my thermos, and start on one of the November cakes. I heated three of them in the oven this morning, along with some stones, and now the stones have kept them nice and hot. I'm feeling quite virtuous and useful as I take out my paper and pencil and the stopwatch that Finn found for me. If I sit here long enough, surely the horses will give up their secrets. I want to know how fast they cover the ground, and then I plan to take Dove over the same stretch and time her as well. If I know what my handicap is, maybe I can prepare better. I've been sitting for about 10 minutes when I catch movement out of the corner of my eye. Someone sits down a few steps away from me, one knee drawn up, an arm resting on top of it.
So, you've discovered the secret to winning, have you, Kate Connolly?
I recognize the voice, without turning my head, and my pulse goes bump, bump, buh, and thinks about starting again, but doesn't quite manage it.
I said you could call me Puck.
Sean Kendrick doesn't say anything else, but he doesn't get up, either. I wonder what he's thinking as we sit here, watching the horses down below. They look so different from above. The training looks orderly, quiet, on purpose, not like the chaos it felt like when I was down there. Even when I see two horses rear up to fight, their handlers working to tear them apart, the sound is muffled by distance and wind, and this somehow lessens it. Toy soldiers. I watch Ian Privet on his grey Pender as they gallop parallel to the water. I click my stopwatch and make a note.
He'll go faster than that, Sean Kendrick says. Later. He's not pressing him now.
I'm not sure if he's being condescending, that I'm bothering to write down this meaningless time, or if he's awarding me with knowledge I wouldn't otherwise have had. So I just trace my pencil over the numbers again, imprinting them into the paper. I want to ask him why he spoke up for me last night, but Mum told me that it was rude to dig for compliments, and this feels like it would be digging for compliments.
so I don't ask. Though I want to badly. Which means we sit in silence some more, the storm wind cutting through my blanket and my hat and ruffling the pages of my notes. I reach into my pack and take one of the precious November cakes, still warm, and offer it to Sean. He takes the cake without saying thank you, but the thank you is somehow implied. I'm not sure how he does it, because I wasn't looking at him to see his face when he took it. After a moment, he says,
"Do you see the black mare, Fawkes? She's excited to chase. If she were mine, I'd keep her just behind the lead, so she'd stay motivated. Make my move late."
I frown down at the beach, trying to see what he sees. The beach is a mess of fake races and aborted gallops. I find Tommy and his black mare and watch them for a moment. She's a fine-legged thing for a Kapalishka, and when she steps, her head bobs just a bit when her left rear hoof touches the ground. "Also," I say, because I have to say something, "she's a bit lame in the left rear."
"The right, I think," Sean Kendrick says,
but then he corrects himself.
"No, left. You're right."
And I feel pleased, although he is only agreeing with what I already knew. Now I feel brave enough to ask him, "Why aren't you riding?" I look at him too when I ask, studying his sharp profile. His eyes jerk back and forth, following the movements down below, though the rest of him stays motionless.
"Racing is about more than riding."
"What are you watching for?"
There is, again, a tremendously long pause between my question and his answer, and I think that he'll just not reply, and then I think that maybe I only thought the question and didn't actually say it. And then I consider that possibly it had been somehow insulting, though by now I can't remember exactly what it was that I said to double-check my words to be sure. And that's when Sean says, "I want to know who's afraid of the water. I want to know who can track straight. I want to know who will tear Cor apart as soon as overtake him. I want to know who can't hold their horses. I want to know how they like to run. I want to know who's lame in the left rear. I want to know how the beach has worn this year. I want to know what the race will look like before it's run."
Down below, the piebald mare screams, loud enough that we both hear it, even up here on the cliff. I can't believe that last night I was regretting not taking her on when I had the chance. I follow Sean's gaze. "And," I say, "you think the piebald mare is something to be watched out for?"
"By you and me both."
Just then, the piebald mare surges forward, exploding along the line of the aggressive surf. She angles sharply toward the sea and jerks back toward the cliff again as quickly. She is so fast that she's gotten to the end of usable beach before I've thought to look at my stopwatch.
"Your brother is going to the mainland," Sean says.
I hold my breath in my mouth for a long moment and finally say, right after the races, "There's no point in treating it as a secret. Everyone knows. He already heard me talking about it with Grattan in the truck."
"And you're not going with him?"
I'm about to answer. He didn't ask, but I realize before I do that that's not the reason anyway. I'm not following him because this is home, and everywhere else isn't. "No."
"Why aren't you going?"
The question infuriates me. I demand, "Why is it that going away is the standard? Does anyone ask you why you stay, Sean Kendrick?"
"They do."
"And why do you?"
"The sky, and the sand, and the sea, and Cor."
It's a lovely answer, and takes me entirely by surprise. I hadn't realized we were having a serious conversation, or I think I would have given a better reply when he asked me. I'm surprised, too, by him including his stallion in his list. I wonder if, when I talk about Dove, people can hear how I love her, the way that I can hear his fondness for Cor in his voice. It's hard for me to imagine loving a monster, though,
no matter how beautiful he is. I remember what the old man said in the butcher's about Sean Kendrick having one foot on land and one foot in the sea. Maybe you need a foot in the sea to be able to see beyond your horse's bloodlust. It's about wanting, I say eventually, after some considering. The tourists always seem to want something. On Thisbe, it's less about wanting and more about being. I wonder, after I say it, if he'll think I sound like I have no drive or ambition. I suppose in comparison to him, it must seem that way. I seem at once cursed to say precisely what I'm thinking to him, and unable to tell what he thinks about it. He says nothing at all. We watch the horses mill and surge below us. Finally, he says, not looking at me.
They'll still try to keep you off the beach. It won't have ended last night.
I don't understand why.
When the races are about proving something about yourself to others, the people you beat are as important as the horse you ride.
His eyes don't leave the piebald. But that's not what they're about for you. Sean pushes up to his feet and stands there. I look at his dirty boots. Now I've offended him, I think.
He says, "Other people have never been important to me, Kate Connolly. Puck Connolly."
I tip my face up to look at him finally. The blanket falls off my shoulders, and my hat, too, loosened by the wind. I can't read his expression. His narrow eyes make it difficult. I say, "And now?" Kendrick reaches to turn up the collar on his jacket. He doesn't smile, but he's not as close to frowning as usual.
"Thanks for the cake."
Then he strides off across through the grass, leaving me with my pencil touching my paper. I feel like I've learned something important about the race to come, but I've no idea how to write it down.
Chapter 35. Sean. The first thing I do when I get back to the yard is search for Benjamin Malvern. I feel the same slanting, groundless sensation that I felt while training fundamental after encountering Puck for the first time, that I felt after the Mare Goddess told me to make another wish. I'd never realized how changeless this changeable island was until it turned into something different than I'd ever known. I find Malvern at the gallops with two men at his elbow. He's got his head jutted forward like he does when he's with buyers, as if he can bully them into buying. The other two men are standing huddled. They look cold and damp, cats left out in the wet. The first thing I notice when I draw closer is the filly they're looking at. Malvern Metal, a filly with promising speed and heart. She's generally willing to do more than she's able, which is always better than the opposite. The next thing I notice is that one of the buyers is George Holly. When he sees me, realization dawns on his expression. He says something to the other buyer and then to Malvern. Malvern nods his head, smiling but looking like he's unhappy about it. He points them back toward the house, and George Holly shepherds the other buyer in that direction. As we pass, Holly juts his hand out in my direction and says, "Sean Kendrick, right? Happy morning." I allow him to shake my hand as if we are strangers, and I raise an eyebrow at his guile. Then he and the other buyer are gone, leaving me to Malvern. I join Malvern by the rail of the gallop. He frowns in the direction of Metal. One of the grooms is riding her, and she's playing and lazy. Metal's got a peculiarly ugly face. Ugliness and coarseness are traits that for some reason seem to accompany the fastest of the thoroughbreds, and right now she is flipping up her mule-like upper lip as she gallops. The groom's not taking her to task, either. I'm not sure if he just doesn't know what she's normally capable of doing, or if he's disinterested. But either way, Metal is taking him for a walk in the park. Malvern speaks finally. "Mr. Kendrick, is this filly always like this?" I consider how to answer. "She's out of Malvern Penny and Pound and by Rostraver. Penny and Pound is one of Malvern's favourite broodmares, and the rumour is that Rostraver's won so much over hurdles on the mainland that no one will race against him. The blood doesn't always come through, Malvern says. He spits and looks back to her. It came through. And she's out for a lark in front of the buyers, is it? All I can think about is what I'm about to ask him. But it's not the right moment. Instead of answering, I grip the rail and slide beneath it, walking across the track to where the groom, another one of Malvern's new ones, no one tolerates the groom's quarters and the pay for long, walks Metal around in a circle, cooling her down. I walk up to Metal and take hold of her bridle. Ho! The groom says to me, surprised. He's young as I am. I think his name is Barnes, but I can't be sure. Maybe Barnes was the last one. Sean Kendrick? With my free hand, I reach up and snatch the crop out of his hands. I haven't even touched Metal with it, and she dances in a circle, pivoting around where I hold her. Malvern is watching you. You're going to take her out again, and you're going to make her work. She's having you on. I was pressing her, Barnes insists. I lightly touch the crop to Metal's hamstrings, and she crow-hops forward as if I've slapped her. She knows my voice, and she feels my certainty where I hold her bridle. Maybe you were, but she didn't believe you. And neither did I. Take this back. Barnes takes the crop and gathers the reins back up again. Metal is trembling and eager now, held only by my touch on her bridle. Barnes looks at me, and I can see that he's scared of the potential, scared of speed. I think he'd better learn to love it soon. I release her bridle and lift my other hand as if I've still got the crop in it, and Metal explodes off the mark, down the gallop. I watch her for a moment to see how Barnes handles himself. He's not half bad, despite his terror, and to see if Metal stays on it. I could have done better, but still, at least she's working now. I walk back to the rail and duck under. Malvern's eyes follow Metal as he scratches his chin. I can hear his fingernails on his skin. I put my hands in my pockets. I don't need a stopwatch to know that Metal has bettered her time. For a moment, I'm silent, reaching for something that will give some weight to what I'm about to say. But there's nothing for it but to just say it. I would buy core from you. Benjamin Malvern casts me a look that is cross, if it is anything, and looks back to the gallop. He produces a stopwatch, which I see now he's had nestled in his hand all this time, and clicks it as Metal reaches the end of the gallop. Mr. Malvern, I say.
I don't like having the same conversation twice. I told you years ago, and I can hear that I'm repeating myself. He's not for sale to anyone. Don't take it personally.
I know, of course, his reasoning for not selling Core. To sell him is to lose a strong contender for the Scorpio races. To sell him is to lose one of the biggest pieces of advertising he has. I understand why you don't want to sell him, I say. But maybe you've forgotten what it was to ride for someone else and not have a horse to call your own. Malvern frowns at his stopwatch, not because Metal was slow, but because she was the opposite.
And I told you before, I'll sell you any of the thoroughbreds.
I didn't make any of those thoroughbreds. I didn't make them what they are, Malvern says.
You made all of them what they are.
I don't look at him. None of them made me who I am. It feels like an incredible confession. I've turned my heart out for Malvern to examine the contents. I've grown up alongside Cor. My father rode him and my father lost him, and then I found him again. He's the only family I have. Benjamin Malvern rubs his great coarse thumb over his chin, and for a moment I think that he's actually considering it. But then he says,
Choose another horse.
I'll train the others. That's the only thing that will change.
Choose another horse, Mr. Kendrick.
I don't want another horse, I say. I want Core. He still doesn't look at me.
If he looks at me, I think I have him. My blood sings in my ears. Malvern says, I'm not having this conversation again. He's not for sale. As Malvern watches the next horse stepping onto the track, I fist my hands in my pockets, remembering how Kate Connolly didn't back down at the Riders' Parade. I remember Holly saying that there must be something that Malvern wanted more than Cor. I remember the Mare Goddess's strange voice. Make another wish. I even think of Mutt Malvern, risking everything for fame on that piebald mare. I had always thought that I'd spent my entire life gambling, risking my life each year on the beach, but I now know that I'd never risked the one thing that I truly was afraid to lose. I don't want to do this. I say very quietly, Then, Mr. Malvern, I quit. He turns his head and one of his eyebrows is raised.
What's that?
I quit. Today. Find another trainer. Find someone else to ride in the races. The faintest hint of a smile moves his lips. I recognize it. Disdain.
Are you trying to blackmail me?
Call it what you like, I say. Sell me Cor, and I'll race for you one last year, and I'll keep on training your horses. On the gallop, a dark bay gelding lopes along, breathing hard. He's not in racing condition yet. Malvern rubs his hand over his lips again, an action that somehow reminds me of metal.
You overestimate your importance to this yard, Mr. Kendrick.
I don't flinch. I'm standing in the ocean, feeling it press against my legs, but I won't let it move me.
Do you think I can't find someone else to ride your stallion?
Malvern asks me. He waits for me to answer, and when I don't, he says,
There are 20 boys I can think of dying to get on the back of that horse.
The image splinters in my heart, and I'm sure he means it to. When I still don't speak, he says,
Well, that's that. Have your things out by the end of the week.
I've never had to be this steady.
Never had to make myself so still and fearless.
I can't breathe, but I make myself hold out my hand.
Don't play that game, Malvern says, without looking at me. I invented it.
The meeting's over. I might never ride Cor again. I don't know who I am without him.
Chapter 36 Puck.
Most of the time, I trust Dove more than just about anybody, but she does have her moments. She doesn't like to be in water above the knee, which on Thisbe is probably wisdom instead of cowardice. As a filly, she had an altercation with a sheep truck, and she has yet to make her peace with them. And she's generally daunted by anything that could be described as weather. I can forgive her these, though, because it's not often I need to plough through a river, or race a sheep truck, or trot to Skarmouth in a gale. But by the time I return to the cliff tops that afternoon, there is definitely weather. The wind cuts straight and low across turf made deep, dark green by the clouds pressing overhead. When the gusts blast across Dove's face, strong enough to check her speed, she spooks and shivers. The air stinks of the Kapil Ishka. Neither of us wants to be here in this night, dark afternoon. But I know we ought to stay. If there is wind or rain on the day of the race, I need Dove to be solid, not the slippery, jerky animal that she is right now. Easy, I tell her, but her ears are swiveling to catch everything but my voice. A howl of wind sends her skittering dangerously close to the cliff edge. For a moment, I see the hump of the cliff grass where it falls over the edge of the rock, toward the froth of the surging ocean far below. I feel the timeless, swimming sensation of possibility. Then I jerk one of the reins and kick her forward. Dove shoots inland, still out of control, twisting and impossible to sit on. I use everything my mother ever told me about riding.
I imagine a string attached to my head pulling down through my spine, tying me to the saddle. I imagine I'm made of sand. I imagine my feet are stones hanging on either side of Dove's belly, too weighty to be shifted. I keep my balance and slow her down, but my heart's hammering. I don't like being afraid of her. This is when Ian Privet arrives. Under this iron sky, he looks dark as a funeral goer. He rides up on his sleek grey Pender, who's not so much dappled as streaked, with white like the storm-crazed ocean down below. A few lengths away from him is Ake Paulson, the baker's son, on a chestnut Ishka mare, and with him is a bay Capel Ishka ridden by Gerald Finney, who's a second cousin, or something, of Ian Privet's. There's an attending group of men on foot, noisy and wind-tossed. I can't imagine why they'd be coming up here, full of purpose, until Tommy Fork trots up behind them on his black mare. When his gaze finds me, there's a warning in it. Ake Paulson leads the way toward me. He looks like his father, the baker, which should be bad, since Giant Nils Paulson has wild tufts of white hair, deep crevices for eyes, and a paunch that looks as if he's smuggling a bag of flour under his shirt. But Ake's squinted eyes only make the shock of his blue eyes more impressive, and his white blonde hair is carefree instead of startling. He's intimidatingly tall, and if there are sacks of flour in his future, his hard frame has no hint of it now. My father always liked Ake. He said, "Ake gets things done," which is a compliment, because on this island, so many people don't. Curled on the back of his chestnut, Ake calls Jolly, "And how is the third Connolly brother doing today?" This earns him a laugh. It's not until the laugh's over that I realize he means me. Finney's bay snaps at Ake as they trot closer. Just a squabble, but the sound of those teeth snapping makes Dove flinch. "It's a shame what passes for humor these days," I reply. I try to hide how much work it's taking for me to hold Dove steady. The wind was bad enough, and now Capel Ishka.
"It's got a bit of currency," Ake says.
I can't see the important parts of his expression in this light, so I can't tell if his smile is a funny one or not.
"Down on the beach, they've started calling you Kevin."
Before I can stop them, my fingers dart self-consciously up to the edge of my hat to feel if any of my hair curls out. Gabe once joked, years ago, that Finn and I looked alike, if you looked at just our faces. I'm a bit ashamed at how much the idea that I might be mistaken for a boy distresses me.
"That's hilarious," I say. "I'm riding in the race, so I must be a boy."
As Ake and Finney come closer, I let Dove trot around in a small circle to hide the fact that I can't hold her in a full stop. Ake shrugs, like he could have thought of better. Behind him, Finney's bay crow hops, crashing into the chestnut, who nearly stumbles into Dove. Dove's fear shivers through the reins. Ake laughs as Finney hurriedly gathers up his bay.
"Pisser," Finney says, pulling his bowler hat down to restore his ego. He jerks his chin in my direction. "Come on, Kevin. Let's see what you got."
"Don't call me that," I reply. He and Ake circle me. Their horse is Dwarf Dove. They must know that it's driving her to a frenzy. "And I was just finishing up," Finney says.
"Come now, be a sport. They said you were a whip."
"I'm not racing you right now," I say. I grid my teeth into a smile.
"But I'll watch you boys."
Ake laughs. It's not a mean laugh, but it's not a thoughtful one either. He says,
"Tommy says you'd race us."
I find Tommy beyond them. He shakes his head.
"Then Tommy doesn't know what he's talking about," I reply. Finney asks, "Where are your balls?"
I need to get away. In the back of my head, I'm thinking that this is going to be a problem. that Dove's going to have to deal with a lot more than this on the day of the race. But that's a faraway concern. The more immediate one is that Dove is shaking and ready to break. You're the one who said I have them, not me. I glance behind me, looking to see if there's room to back Dove away from them. A few drops of rain spatter across my face. The worst of it is that there's nothing mean about Finny and Ake. They're being just like Joseph Beringer. Only Joseph Beringer never teases me from the back of a massive Kapil Ishka.
The bookies are here, Finny says,
elbowing back toward the onlookers.
Don't you want to show them something better than your 45-1?
Finny lets his bay jostle into Ake's mare again, and the chestnut shoves against Dove hard. I hear teeth snapping, and Dove squeals, the wind ripping through her mane. I cling to her as she rears. Behind her left ear, I see a shallow scrape where the Kapil's teeth grazed her. The blood wells up in a dozen small drops.
Give me some room! I shout.
I'm simultaneously terrified and humiliated as I hear myself. It's the voice of a scared little girl. Ake and Finny hear it too, because their faces change. Ake hauls on his chestnut's reins so hard that she nearly rears. Finny kicks his bay away from Dove. They're both looking at me, Ake especially, with apologies in their expressions. Dove lifts her head to the wind and whinnies, shrill and terrified. Ake keeps backing his horse away. I'm relieved to have distance between her and the Kapil Ishka, but at the same time, I'm ashamed down to my bones by the space suddenly surrounding me. From their vantage point nearby, the bookies wipe moisture from their hats and murmur to each other before they walk away without a glance back for me. Ian Privett, still watching from Penda, nods to Ake before he turns as well.
Later, Kate,
Ake says, not quite meeting my eyes, suddenly demure. He lays his reins against his chestnut mare's neck, and she pivots back toward Skarmouth. Finny touches his hat and is gone as well. The cliff top seems quiet now, just the wind and the sound of intermittent drops sinking into the grass around me. I cannot stop hearing the sound of my own voice, and every time I do, I feel a little smaller. Tommy's face is pensive. For a moment, it looks like he's starting toward me, but at the movement of his Ishka mare, Dove squeals and lays her ears back again. So he merely waves at me, with just one hand close to his reins, and follows the others. I'm left alone, the gusts beating the breath out of me. I'm furious with Dove for being so fearful, but I'm more furious with myself. Because it doesn't matter how brave I've been, or how brave I will be. It only took a casual handful of minutes to convince everyone here that I don't belong on the beach.
Chapter 37 Puck. That night, Finn and I make a picnic in Dove's one-sided lean-to. Dove is still strung out and fretful, and I don't think she'll touch her hay unless I'm out there with her. And Finn says that the storm's going to keep us inside for a few days anyway, so we might as well be outside while we can. Also, Mum used to tell us to picnic outside when we were being horrid and loud in the house, so it has a sort of comfortable nostalgia to it. Of course, it's getting dark, and it's drizzling fitfully, but still, under the lean-to it's dry, and an electric lantern provides enough light to see our soup by. I break open one of the cheap bales of hay to use as a blanket over our legs, and we lean back against the wall of the lean-to. Finn, sensing my black mood, clinks the edge of his bowl against mine as a cheers. Dove stands half in and half out of the lean-to and picks at her hay. I have a clear view of the scratch on her neck from here, and again, I hear the sound of my cry on the clifftop. I can't stop wondering what would have happened if I just galloped with them when they'd first asked. I can't stop seeing their faces
as they pulled their horses back from Dove. For a few minutes, we're all silent, slurping potatoes and broth, listening to Dove's teeth, grinding up the expensive hay, and the sound of the light rain whispering across the metal roof of the lean-to. Finn piles more hay across his legs for insulation. Outside, the sky is going blue, brown, and black at the edges.
"She looks faster already," Finn says.
He slurps the bottom of his soup to annoy me, and then smacks his lips to make sure he succeeded. I set my own empty bowl on the hay bale behind me and take a piece of bread. My stomach still feels empty.
"Can you come at me again with that sound? I don't think I heard you." "You're in a black mood," Finn says.
I think of three things I could reply to that, and in the end, just shake my head. If I say it out loud, it will only make it harder to forget. Finn is enough of a private creature that he doesn't try to make me speak. He spreads the hay thin, and then thick again over his legs, trying to make it even. After a long pause, he says, "What do you think will happen?"
"Happen when?"
"With the race. And with Gabe. What do you think will happen to us?" Crossly, I throw a stick of hay toward Dove.
"Dove will eat her expensive food, and the Kapil Ishka will eat beef liver, and the bets will all be against us. But on the day of the race, it'll be warm and windy, and Dove will go straight, while the others go right, and we'll be the richest people on the island. You'll drive three cars at the same time, and Gabe will decide to stay, and we'll never have to eat beans again."
"Not that one," Finn says, like he'd asked for a story, and I'd picked the wrong one.
"What will really happen?"
"I'm not a fortune teller."
"What about if you don't win? I'm not saying anything bad about Dove, but what if she doesn't make any money?"
I glance at him to see if he's picking at his arms yet, but he's just mutilating a piece of hay.
"We lose the house. Benjamin Mulvern kicks us out."
Finn nods at his hands, like he'd guessed this before. Gabe had underestimated both of us. "And then I guess..." I try to imagine what it will look like if I fail.
"I guess I will have to sell Dove, and we'd have to find somewhere to live. If we got a job, the living could come with it, if it was something like cleaning, or at the mill. There's mill housing."
"No one wants a life at the mill." I try to think of something else truthful, but not so dire.
"Grattan said he was eyeing you as an apprentice. I know you couldn't, but maybe he'd consider me instead."
Finn says,
"I'd do it." "You couldn't bear it."
He's demolished the hay in his hands. It's just dust.
"You couldn't bear to ride in the race either, but you are. I reckon I could learn to bear it if I had to."
I don't want him to learn to bear it, though. I want to keep my sweet, innocent brother the way he is, and I want to keep my best friend Dove here beside me. And I don't want to trade the house I grew up in for a tiny flat and a mill job.
"But it won't happen that way," I say. "The first way is how it's going to happen."
Finn shreds another piece of hay. So does Dove. And just then, there's an odd creak. The lean-to's metal roof is old, so there's plenty to creak there, and its one wall forms part of the fence. So where the boards meet the posts of the lean-to, there's yet another chance of creaking. And the fence itself is not the youngest thing on the island, so really, it could creak anywhere there's a joint. But this isn't that sort of creak. It's more like a creak plus a knock. Not quite a knock, softer, a pat. I can't think of how I even heard it, really. Once I think about it, until I see Finn looking at me, completely still, and realize I didn't just hear it, I felt it. Finn and I both turn our heads toward the lean-to wall that we lean against. I want to say, maybe it was Puffin, but Dove has stopped chewing and has pricked her ears toward the sound, though of course there's nothing to see. I don't think she'd prick them for a cat. Finn and I sit motionless. The drizzle goes on the roof. We're trying not to look at each other, because looking would make it harder to hear. There's nothing. Nothing at all. Just the rain on the roof.
Dove's still listening, but there's nothing to hear. It was just the lean-to settling. Our little electric lantern makes a circle of yellow up on the ceiling. The world is quiet. Then,
woof! And the unmistakable sounds of slow steps on the other side of the wall. It's not the sound of feet. It's a sound of hooves. We stare at each other. There is the creak pat again, and this time we both know what it is. I feel the experimental push on the other side of the wall, and I bite my lip, hard. With a questioning expression, Finn puts a finger on the switch to the electric light. I shake my head furiously. The only thing I can think of that's worse than facing a Kapil Ishka in this drizzly night is to do it without light. Instead, I start to burrow down into the hay blanket I've made, slowly, to keep the pieces from making noise. Finn immediately follows my lead. Dove's ears swivel to follow an invisible signal on the other side of the wall. If I strain my ears, I can hear the sound of a hoof hitting the ground, then another. Another exhale of breath, no louder than the rain on the roof. I don't know what the Kapil Ishka is doing. Maybe it'll lose interest. Maybe it'll be discouraged by the fence between it and us. In my head, I trace the steps we'd have to take to get back to the house, around the other side of the lean-to, down two sections of fence, over the metal tube gate, then 15 feet to the door. Maybe one of us would get over the gate in time. That's not enough. The night is dark and silent. I strain my ears for another hoof step. Dove's attention remains fixed on the last point where the sound came from. Finn, mostly covered in hay, meets my gaze. His jaws clenched. The mist hisses over the roof. Water drips down off the edge of the metal, one drop, two drops at a time, making a soft, barely audible sound when it lands on the ground. Somewhere far away, I hear what sounds like a car engine, maybe. The wind teases the hay. There's nothing from the other side of the wall. Dove jerks to attention. Looking in the side of the lean-to is a long, black face. It is the devil. It takes everything in me not to whimper. The creature is black as peat at midnight, and its lips are pulled back into a fearsome grin. The ears are long and wickedly pointed toward each other, less like a horse and more like a demon. They remind me of shark egg pouches. The nostrils are long and thin to keep the sea out. Eyes black and slick. A fish's eyes. It still stinks like the ocean, like low tide, and things caught on rocks. It's barely a horse. It's hungry. The Kapil Ishka has hooked its head around the side of the lean-to, over the fence. All that stands between us and its strangely light grin is three boards that I nailed up myself while Mum watched. Three nails, not two, into each, because ponies, she said, will test everything. And now this night black horse presses its chest against them. Not hard. Only as hard as it had pushed against the lean-to wall. The nails creak. I can hear my heart, or Finn's heart, or maybe the both of them, and it's going so fast and loud that I can't breathe. My hands are fisted over the hay, the nails biting into my palms. We're hidden. You can't see us. Go away. Dove is utterly still. The Kapil Ishka looks at her and opens its jaw, and then it makes a sound that turns my blood into ice. It's a hissed exhalation, with low clucks behind it, clicking from somewhere deep in its throat. Dove flattens her ears back to her head, but doesn't move. How many times have we been told that the Kapil Ishka want a moving target? That to move is to die. Dove is a statue. The Kapil Ishka pushes again. The boards creak again. I hear Finn sigh. It's so quiet that I know no one but me could have heard it, and only me because I spent my whole life listening to every sound that my brothers could possibly make. It's a soft, scared little noise that I haven't heard him make in a long time. Then I hear a wail. It's coming from out in the pasture. Both Dove and the Kapil Ishka flick an ear toward it. It comes again, and my stomach is an endless pit. It's another one, I think, that's pushed down the fence on the other side. That's in the pasture with us. Not even 3 nails aboard to keep us alive. The black monster swivels its strange long ears again. The wail again. It sounds a little like a baby crying, and then I see Finn's mouth moving. It's about all I can see of him. He mouths at me with exaggerated syllables. Puffin. The sound. Again. And this time, I recognize it immediately. Puffin, the barn cat, always in search of Finn, back from her travels and drawn by our light. She wails again, her baby cry meow, that she uses to call him. When he's feeling indulgent, he'll repeat it back to her, and she'll use the sound as a homing beacon. Now she cries again, closer, and the Kapil Ishka shifts its weight away from the fence. In the grey light of the mist that the rain drives up from the ground, I see Puffin's form, trotting toward us, her tail, a question mark. Wow? She asks. The Kapil Ishka's grin closes. Puffin sees the Kapil Ishka only when it moves. The fence tears like paper, the boards exploding off with a sound like the world being destroyed. She bolts, and the Kapil Ishka charges after her, made hungrier by the chase. They both vanish into the mist, and the last thing I hear is hooves scrabbling, frenzied, and then Puffin wailing. Finn covers his face, the hay falling from his hands, and I see his shoulders shake. I can't think about that, though. I think about this, the Kapil Ishka coming back and killing my brother. I grab his shoulder. Come on! I don't have a plan yet, but I know we can't stay. From behind me, I hear a sound, and I jerk so hard my muscles hurt. It takes a full second for me to realize it's a voice, saying my name. Puck! It's Gabe, stepping through the ruined bit of fence the horse has just plunged through. His voice is a hiss as he takes my arm. Hurry up! He'll come back! I'm so shocked to see him. Now of all times, that at first I can't get the words out. Dove! What about Dove? Bring her, snaps Gabriel, just audible. Finn, wake up! Come on! I snatch up Dove's halter. She tosses her head in the air and jerks my arm at the shoulder. She's trembling, like she was on the clifftop. Puffin, I tell Gabe. She's a cat. I'm sorry, but come on. Gabe pulls at Finn. There's 2 others. They're coming. Gabe leads the way back through the ruined fence. When I get Dove to the fence, she pulls back, held by the memory of it being a barrier, and for a brief, terrible moment, I think I'll have to leave her behind. I cluck softly, and she finally steps over the broken boards. In front of the house, I see headlights. And now, there's Tommy Falk, with half his face illuminated. He jerks open the car door and gestures hurriedly for Finn to get in. Gabe appears beside me with a lead rope. Hold it out the window! But now! And just as he says that, I hear the same cluck
that I heard earlier, only now it comes from somewhere in the paddock, where we just were.
Distantly, I hear it echo back through the mist, an answering sound. I clip the lead onto Dove's halter and scramble into the car. Tommy Forks, already behind the wheel, and Gabe slams the door after himself. Then we're off, down the narrow road, the headlights reflected in the mist and rain as they jump back up from the ground. Beside us, Dove trots and then canters. I roll up the window to leave just enough room for the lead to fit through. Tommy Fork is utterly focused on his driving, checking the mirrors constantly, making sure that we're not being followed, taking care to make it easy for Dove to keep up with us. And the intensity of it makes me remember, suddenly, that I saw him on the beach just earlier today. The car is silent and hot. The heater was turned up all the way and no one's thought to turn it down.
The entire car smells, not unpleasantly, of the inside of a new shoe.
Beside me, in the back seat, Finn is insensible because of Puffin.
The only thing that's said is when Gabe turns his face to Tommy and asks,
"Your place?" Tommy says, "Not with the pony. Has to be beaches."
Then Finn pinches me and points out the front window. Just illuminated by the headlights is a dead sheep. It's mutilated and strung out all the way from the ditch to the middle of the road. I can't stop seeing its torn body, even after we have left it far behind. That could have been us. Tommy and Gabe don't comment on it, however. They don't comment on anything, actually. They sit in grim, familiar silence, Gabe looking out windows and communicating to Tommy that it's all clear without saying a word.
Tommy doesn't take the road to Skarmouth, as I expected, but rather the one toward Hastaway.
He slows at the crossroads, but doesn't stop, and both he and Gabe peer anxiously out in all directions until we get going once more. I press my face to the glass to make certain that Dove is not having a hard time keeping up.
"I could ride her and follow you," I say.
Gabe's voice leaves no room for negotiation.
"You're not getting out of this car until we're well clear."
And then there's silence again, nothing but night and stone walls and the rain.
"Finn," Gabe says, finally, his voice raised to be heard over the sound of the engine. "This storm that's coming, how long will it last?"
Finn's eyes are bright in the back seat, and he's so incredibly pleased to have been asked that it hurts me.
"Just tonight and tomorrow."
Gabe looks at Tommy.
"One day. That's not long."
"Long enough," says Tommy.
Chapter 38. Puck. Tommy Fork takes us to the Grattan's house, which is near Hastaway. Though how near I can't be sure, because everything looks the same in the spitting rain and narrow yellow of the headlights. Beach meets us, his shoulders hunched against the wind, and shows me where I can leave Dove. He swings his torch around to reveal a little four-stall stable with a low ceiling and no electric lights. One of the stalls is occupied by damp goats, another by chickens, and one by a grey cob gelding who stretches his head over the unbarred stall door when Dove comes in. Dove flattens her ears back by way of an ungrateful hello, but I put her in the stall next to him anyway. I want to spend more time with her, but it feels rude to linger while Beach stands there illuminating the stall with the light. So I just pat her neck and tell Beach thank you. He grunts and points back toward the house with his flashlight. Back in the house, Gabe and Peg Grattan are talking easily while Tommy Fork peers under the lid of a pot on the stove. I don't see Finn. The kitchen itself reminds me of the butcher shop, if the butcher shop was made into a house. Despite the dark outside, the kitchen is all bright, whitewashed walls and pots and knives hung up on them. The image of clean whiteness isn't at all diminished by the fact that the floor is filthy with footprints. There are knick-knacks on a half-dozen shelves, but they're entirely different from our sort of knick-knacks. crude wooden statues that could be either horses or deer, a broom of grass with a red ribbon tied around it.